Coffee lovers know that the secret to making the best cup of coffee is starting with freshly roasted beans. But getting your hands on fresh coffee can be easier said than done. Or at least it was until Sparkplug Coffee came to the rescue. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half calf. But best of all, they deliver this excellent coffee to your home or office within a week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it's always fresh and at its peak flavor. You will taste the difference. Sparkplug even offers autopilot, set it and forget it delivery so that you'll never run out of fresh coffee again. It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. So plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hey, gang, and we thank you for hammering your thumb on that play button to listen to the next 100 project. The weekly, well, almost weekly, we were off last week, podcast that blathers about classic motion pictures. We will alert you right now that we'll be completely spoiling today's movie. I'm the melodramatic guy who leads his troops into a stupid suicide mission, Ryan Ellis. And with me on the couch is the egomaniacal dillweed who gave me that assignment, my wife, Biff.
You ready to kill some Germans?
Oui! These are Frenchmen, let's not forget.
Yes.
All right, the coming attractions trivia for this week's picture, Paths of Glory. And we had this movie before in a previous Kubrick movie, I believe. But anyway, we'll do it again. How many actors headlined more than one Kubrick movie, didn't appear in, but was the main star in?
The star, so Sterling Hayden wouldn't count.
No.
Then it's just two. It's just Kirk Douglas, who was the lead in Paths of Glory, and he played Spartacus in Spartacus. And Frank Silvera was the lead in both Fear and Desire and Killer's Kiss.
You did better research than me. I didn't even look back that far.
Oh, really? I mean, Kubrick doesn't really consider those films Kubrick canon, so I guess it's debatable. But
Fear and Desire, he disowned.
Yes.
All right, well, then there's two, because I only have Kirk Douglas in my notes. That was what we talked about, whatever that podcast was, is the trivia way back when, that it was Nicholson, or it was Peter Sellers, or it was Malcolm McDowell. Tom Cruise, obviously, at the end of his career, but he didn't use anybody else more than once as a main star.
After Dr. Strangelove, he barely reused actors in big roles
again. Except for
being Joe Turkle playing the bartender in The Shining.
Three movies in total he worked with him on, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, but actors just wouldn't work with him over again after a while for whatever reason, maybe because of his nature, or maybe he just didn't like to cast the same people.
I think it's more that he didn't want to cast them again because they would have known they'd be in a prestigious movie and generally a successful movie. Kubrick did pretty well at the box office. Despite the way he was known to be a perfectionist that went over budget, his movies ended up doing pretty well. All right, let's get into this one. The next 100 Project's 63rd movie, Paths of Glory, was most definitely nominated for the 1998 and 2007 AFI Top 100 lists. Didn't make it, of course. It was probably more worthy than a similar type of movie, All Quiet on the Western Front.
I think All Quiet on the Western Front was probably more innovative. Probably was a more influential film than Paths of Glory because it really was the first successful, critically acclaimed sound picture of a war film.
And Western Front was bumped up the second list, but Paths missed both times. I'm just saying that they're very similar in Paths to make the list.
Paths' real competition is probably more Bridge on the River Kwai. Came out the same year.
Which was a slam dunk, though.
Yes, exactly. And it even kind of explores similar themes. Plus, Kubrick's really well represented in
films, right?
Right,
he had four in total. Spartacus in the second list, and the other three big ones. We'll talk about them as we go through in the first and second list. Anyway, United Artists cut the film loose in the U.S. 60 years ago during Christmas week, 1957. It certainly wasn't a blockbuster, but it almost broke even. It came pretty close. Well, Bev, remind people what it's about with The Skinny.
Kirk Douglas is Colonel Dax, an officer in the French army stuck in the trench stalemate of 1916 during World War I. After leading a doomed mission to take the German anthill, he must defend his men in a kangaroo court against accusations of cowardice. The stakes are high. It's the lives of his men against the reputations of the officers who sent them on an ill-wrought suicide mission in the first place.
Or in a nutshell, the very best way to win a war is to get as many of your own men killed as possible.
As long as you get a promotion out of it, then you must have done something right.
A few numbers first. The Rotten Tomatoes critics, 94% of them liked the movie, 51 fresh, only 3 rotten, and 95% of audiences, so great scores. And it's 58th on the IMDb's top 250. I think most of Kubrick's movies, certainly the big ones everyone knows, are somewhere on there. I think The Shining's even higher than this. 2001 is probably a little lower. Yeah. Strangelove is on there somewhere, I'm sure. Spartacus probably is.
Paths of Glory is kind of more of a deep cut for Kubrick fans.
And not as well known as his other films. A skinny was probably required for this more than most other movies to remind people what it's about. It was banned in France for nearly 20 years, and it was banned or censored elsewhere too, including the U.S. military, because of course it's all about the way the military treats people so badly. Very controversial movie. Maybe that's why it didn't make the AFI list as well. And the title is based on a Thomas Gray poem, which has a passage in it, "The paths of glory lead but to the grave." That's also a theme that we've seen and will certainly see in the next couple years in the TV show Game of Thrones. George R.R. Martin has said that the best way for that, most appropriate way at least for that show to end, is a graveyard with wind rustling through and all the names of the people we ever cared about all there on tombstones, because in the end, what does it matter? You're all going to die. It's just about when and why. It's a short movie. It's not even 90 minutes long. It doesn't waste time in unnecessary shit or much backstory. I've wasted enough time. Let's get you in here. What do you think about Paths of Glory?
I love Paths of Glory. I called it a deep cut for Kubrick fans, but I think it's like one of his best. It's one of my favorites. It's extraordinarily affecting and moving and well done. It's also pretty taut. It's economical, entertaining, and you will not stop thinking about it for days. It's really an excellent film.
You said 2 weeks ago when we did Alien that they don't waste time on a backstory. We don't even find out anything about these people in their life back home. We learn more about Ripley as the series went on and Aliens and so on. That's true, but in the first movie you don't. This is the same thing. It's all about the trenches, and it's all about the kangaroo court stuff, and it's all about the murder of these guys, and then the movie's over.
You learn a lot about them just from watching them, seeing what they're wearing, seeing their surroundings, seeing the way they carry themselves, but it's true, there's very little backstory, and you eventually learn a couple people who admit to having a family back home, but...
Well, most people have a family of some type. It's just about dwelling on that so much, maybe showing that, and a lot of movies have done that. Saving Private Ryan, even though you're not a huge fan, is pretty economical for a long movie in that way, too. Tom Hanks talks about his wife back home in one scene, but otherwise we don't really learn about any of those guys either. That's been done well in plenty of movies, war movies or whatever, that tell you all about the character's backstory, and sometimes that's been critical. But you don't have to dwell on it, and this one is a great example.
And this is a great example of a movie getting a tremendous amount of pathos for your characters without dwelling on these backstories. You don't need to know where they came from to know that their situation is tragic and that what's happening to them is awful, unfair, and absolutely despicable and a true tragedy.
I think it's a great film, too, if I didn't already say that. Clearly, it's one of his best films. That's saying a lot, though, because he's got so many excellent films in his resume. It's not the one I'd watch first. That would be Strangelove, and 2001 is the greatest, maybe, of all of them. Clockwork Orange is pretty fun in its weird way, and The Shining, but this is certainly right up there with them. And this is better than Spartacus, by the way. That would be the second list. This movie should have made it certainly more than that.
Paths of Glory is probably not going to be my first one that I would put in, but I would put it in before I'd watch 2001 again, I think. It's just more entertaining, but it's also kind of a downer, so it's a little discouraging.
All right, so this World War film has an opening narration. That's a Kubrick custom, that or title cards. And the guy delivering the narration in the beginning is the guy who's the judge at the Kangaroo Court. But you don't hear his voice ever again. There's a narration in Dr. Strangelove at the very beginning, and never again. This is also a strange story because the Kangaroo Court is all about killing their own men during an ongoing war. And we keep saying that word Kangaroo Court. There is no way these three guys were ever going to be found not guilty.
No.
And the story is all about institution over the individual, which was also true in our last podcast 2 weeks ago, Alien, where the people in charge are more important than the individuals. Who cares about them?
I wouldn't even say it's the institution above the individual, because the decisions that the officers are making are not what's best for the French army. They're what's best for them personally and their own glory, their own standing, promotions.
I'm projecting as to what the people in charge in the country itself would have done, and I think they would have approved this because that's the way things are. They always back up the military unless they need a scapegoat. And I guess in the end, Moreau has made the scapegoat because it's actually Brouard who pits Moreau against Dax at one point. He is the bastard, but he even makes the point, where am I at fault here? And when he said that and he talks about what he's done, I thought, he's got a point, but he's still the bad guy. And he represents the military, at least in the movie we have. There's so many levels of military. He may be a middle management type. That's something that The Wire, David Simon talked about, was influential in his series, the middle management stuff. As important as the generals are, Brouard and Moreau, and then Colonel Dax and so on, they're still middle managers compared to the people in charge of France. And I'm saying it again, I think the president of France would approve what Brouard has them do by trying to take the anthill.
Well, he's one of them. The president is among that bureaucracy. One of the things the movie clearly illustrates is the class difference between the officers and the foot soldiers. The foot soldiers are filthy. They're in the trenches. They're crammed together. It's uncomfortable. They look miserable. And they're very powerless. The officers literally live in a palace. We are constantly reminded of how opulent and comfortable their life is. And so it's easy to imagine how they consider themselves so separate from these other people, so much so that they don't even really see them as humans, but as pawns that they can play in this war.
Because they are.
And they convince themselves that they're doing right, but they're so blind to their own privilege, they forget that these are people that they're dealing with. Of course, Colonel Dax lives with his men, and so he sees them as people, and he kind of bridges those two worlds, but absolutely sympathizes with his men because he sees their faces, he talks to them, he understands that they're individuals, whereas the officers are just so oblivious and removed.
Well, the soldiers are the ones who are going to win the war, because this is before nukes. Nobody's going to drop a huge bomb and just end something the way the Americans or a lot of other countries could do now.
And that reminds me of Dr. Strangelove when they're trying to decide whether or not they should enter into a nuclear war. General Turgeson is like, I'm not saying we're not going to get our hair mussed. 10, 20 million tops, depending on the bricks.
He means civilians, too.
But yeah, that he's talking about dying. And he's like, listen, people are going to die. And in war, people die. I guess if you're fighting a war, you have to have people who are in jobs where they understand that people are going to die and be able to mitigate this many deaths versus this many deaths. You are going to have to make a decision where you know that you're sending people to die, but their deaths may save more lives than you put at risk. I understand that generals have to make that decision. This movie's pretty clear that that's not what's happening. No. It's obvious right from the get-go that the anthill is insurmountable. They're never going to win this battle. Even Moreau knows that it's unwinnable.
And until he's given the chance to get a promotion, then suddenly, oh, we can do this after all.
Yeah, the illustration is a little on the nose, to be honest. I didn't like that scene. Not only was the writing really transparent, but there was also, like, a lot of weird blocking and then walking circles around each other for no reason and the camera following them. It seemed a little show-offy and not something that I would associate with Kubrick.
He was still new, though, to films. Yeah, he was exactly. Probably trying to find his footing. That part, the opening where Brouard gives Moreau the assignment and then Moreau passes it on to Dax and they end up doing this stupid thing, is the Three Stooges approach to warfare. Because they're repeatedly trying and failing at the same task. Woo-woo-woo-woo-woo! Numbskull! Yeah, numbskull, stop trying to do something that's not going to work. And Moreau is a bastard, but Brouard cons him into taking the assignment. Moreau's ambitions cost so many lives, but isn't that what war is always about anyway? Generals don't improve morale, they inspire fear. And the leaders in this movie are always selling out subordinates. Except for Dax.
Yes. And the powerful use men as pawns to satisfy their own ambitions and egos or fears of personal incrimination. Sounds like a pretty accurate microcosm of war to me. This is the level with the generals and the foot soldiers, but don't you believe that wars probably start in the first place because politicians are having these same conversations behind closed doors and having these same negotiations where they're really looking out for their own best interests first?
And in the end, they're not the ones that ever do the fighting.
Exactly.
Thousands of years ago, the person who was leading the army was the person who was actually leading the army rather than going in the trenches once in a while and quote-unquote improving morale, which doesn't improve anything. Yes. Like I say, just scaring
people. Slapping
people
in the face.
And then leaving the battlefield. I mean, he's still in the battlefield, but he's not a part of it. He's not the one that has the whistle like Dax does and actually goes out on the charge. But back in the Hannibal days, or Napoleon, or whomever, those people were actually out front. And in so many wars, really all wars probably, soldiers have fought so hard and so often over useless land. The battlefield in this movie, no man's land. It's just some farmer's field. In reality, that's what they used for the set. But it spotlights what we actually have in so many wars where they're going to go out in the middle of nowhere and they're going to fight and it's over nothing. It reminds me of the Kilgore speech in Apocalypse Now, the one that everyone loves so much. And I think people always miss the point of that speech, the love the smell of napalm in the morning speech. We firebombed the hill. We went back. There was not one. Not one stinking dink body. Because they weren't even fucking there. You were fighting for something no one even wanted in the first place. And if they were there, it was probably useless land anyway.
Kubrick made a lot of war films.
The one subject of a movie, the one topic he came back to more than once, I guess three times, because Dr. Strangelove is both a comedy and a war film, and then Full Metal Jacket, of course, is a full-on war film.
Fear and Desire is a war film, too, but again, we don't consider that canon.
He didn't, so that's
no,
why
exactly.
I was forgetting about it.
But it's still a topic that he was passionate about. Mm-hmm. The very first film he ever made was a war film, whether it was a successful film or not. And other topics he didn't come back to. He didn't come back to sci-fi, he didn't come back to horror, he didn't come back to crime film, really, like The Killing. He didn't make movies like that over and over again, but he was a pacifist, famously, He hated war and for his whole life was horrified by the Holocaust.
He wanted to make a movie about the Holocaust, right. Mm. And then Spielberg beat him to it. I think he realized, well, he said better than I was going to, or at least as well as I was going to. So
he's the only director to ever be like, oh, someone already made a film about the Holocaust. Well, then they beat him to it.
He wanted to make a Napoleon film with Nicholson, and that fell apart. That's the other failed subject matter he wanted to get into. And then he was going to do AI, but of course Spielberg took it over, the script notes and whatnot, and then actually made the film. Kubrick wasn't going to direct that anyway. He was going to be the producer on it for Spielberg.
And he said about making war films, conflict is natural, when it would, in a less critical situation, have to be introduced almost as a contrivance, and would thus appear forced, or even worse, false.
Earlier today I watched a Western, a John Wayne Western, in fact. And that's the other genre that's probably the most easy to get into. You know what the stakes are in those kinds of films, generally. Some have been a little different. Butch and Sundance end up being the quote-unquote bad guys in their movie, even though they are heroes. But usually with war and Western, it's not easy, but finding your footing as the viewer is easy.
Mm-hmm. And that's why there's so many shows about either crime or hospitals on television yeah. all the time, because you just have these workplaces where conflict is the job. There's always going to be drama. It's just baked into the cake.
Earlier in the movie, we had a morbid conversation about the best way to die, and that is both sad, tragic, and not funny, but fitting for this film, and it's either by rifle or bayonet. And it reminded me of that whole thing, I think it's a Seinfeld joke, or maybe it was said before Jerry Seinfeld, but people are most afraid of public speaking over dying. So if you're at a funeral, you'd rather be in the casket than be the one giving the eulogy.
And in this case, they say they'd rather be dead from a gunshot than injured from a bayonet. This was before antibiotics. A good bayonet injury would probably take you out anyway, but it would be a far more painful death. But the conclusion that they reach is, well, you're more afraid of pain than death. Although, this movie really clearly illustrates the fear of death. You see three condemned men suffering their last hours, waiting for the inevitable.
And not by a bayonet, but they know it's going to happen. Yeah. So it's the same idea. Stop doing it by a thousand cuts. Just shoot me right fucking now.
Oh, yeah. And they're miserable. You know, they don't just face their death honorably. There isn't an 11th hour savior. Although there's almost like a tease that there's going to be.
Most movies would have had something like that.
Yes. Most directors would have saved these men. But Kubrick was like, no, I'm going to show you what really happens. Oh, and for the record, this really happened during World War I. Mm-hmm. And the French army really did this to people, picking just a few soldiers to pay with their lives for the crime of an entire unit. Mm. Rather than kill the entire unit and have them all be executed.
It's good for morale.
Yeah, good for morale to just gotta kill soldiers once in a while. You just gotta make sure they don't turn around and go coward. I mean, there's plenty of stories from World War II. In Russia, soldiers would turn around to run away from battle and just get shot by everybody coming up. You know, it was like your job to shoot soldiers who were trying to desert.
And as awful as that is, it makes more sense because at least it's quick and it's in the moment. And there's no debate about it. There's no morality to it the same kind of way. Okay, there's morality, but it's not the same as having people be tried in a kangaroo court
and then
have a night and then die in this stupid thing while the war is still going on.
And if there was any justice, the people paying for this crime would be the dumb officers who knew it was a suicide mission and agreed to make it happen anyway. They're the criminals, and they sit there smugly in their palace and give death sentences to these innocent men, all three of them. They're not perfect men. You have the outcast, you have the scapegoat, and you have the poor guy that was just chosen by lot.
Joe Turkel was in three Kubrick movies.
And who was a hero. His character was a hero.
Prior Bravery, and he's the one who has an accident when he lunges at, what's his name again, Paris. He may not make it through the night, but they keep him alive just to shoot him the next day.
Yeah, and then try to get him conscious. It's such an incredible image. When I talk about how affecting this film is, I'm really talking about the last act of the film after the conviction has come down, and it starts with this red herring that you think that the revelation that General Moreau wanted to strike his own men with artillery because he thought they were being cowards. You think that's going to turn it all around, but Kubrick let it fall flat because this movie isn't here to make us feel good by any means. And another film would have spared the audience the insight into those last hours of those men's lives, like perhaps a maudlin speech about the unfairness of it all. Instead, we see their anger, their bargaining, their disbelief, and most of all, really raw grief, tremendous performances. And we're not allowed to look away from the consequences of the machinations of these out-of-touch generals. Even after seeing this movie three times, I still am reflexively waiting for someone to save them at the last minute. Because they don't deserve to die, they don't want to die, And they don't have to die. The only sentimental indulgence that Kubrick gives into is letting Dax remain the hero. He gets offered a promotion. He angrily turns it down. He remains pure, and that's perhaps the only cathartic moment we're given. And if you felt good at all, well, then he really sucks the air out of the room with that beautiful, incredibly moving song at the end.
Sung by Kubrick's future wife.
Roger Ebert says in Casablanca, La Marseillaise, when they sing that, is one of the most uplifting moments in film. But you could say that this moment at the end of Paths of Glory is the complete opposite. Because it's instead meant to illustrate the emptiness of patriotism and the horrors of what patriotism has driven these men to do.
And they're being awful to Suzanne Christian, which of course is Christiane Hartland, I guess is her last name, but she became Christiane Kubrick. They were married for about 40 years, in fact. And that's that great twist where she very quickly changes them from being whistling assholes into supporting, not really supporting, I guess, but going along with it, singing along. But I ask this, even allowing the men some fun, as Dax does when he hears them singing and they're gonna go back to the front, we'll give them a few more minutes. Is allowing them those few more minutes in that bar even a bit ludicrous? I'm not criticizing Dax for doing it, but if they're going to go off to die anyway, which also leads me to the question about the whole movie, what happens to those poor three guys who were shot dead unjustifiably? Do they still maybe have better existence than going off into those trenches and waiting to die?
And this is what you're forced to think about during that last scene when the camera goes in for these individual close-ups with these men who barely have speaking parts but give these really beautiful performances, and there's misery in their faces, the tears coming down when they hear the song of their enemy. But it doesn't matter. They don't know the words. They're humming along. They're just aching so much for any semblance of home or feeling. And they still have this sense of humanity. You know, the officers don't, but even the soldiers at the end, they indulge in picking on that German woman who's at their mercy, but their own suffering is just too close to hers, and her humanity ends up overwhelming them. They can't escape their own empathy. There's just so much humanity in that scene. And so we just saw those three soldiers die, and then we're forced to look in the faces of, we know not every last one of them is doomed, but we know that not every last one of them is going home either.
Any one of them could have been the person who was court-martialed and shot dead earlier that day, or maybe next week when the same kind of thing happens again.
And every last one of them is at the mercy still of those same cruel officers.
I remember Steven Spielberg talked about this. I think it was on the Eyes Wide Shut making of when he sits down to have an interview. It was weird. Why is Steven Spielberg on this? He has nothing to do with the movie. But that's when he revealed he'd been friends with Kubrick for many years. And then, of course, AI came a few years after Eyes Wide Shut came out. And Spielberg said that when Kubrick died, he got together with some friends and he ran the last reel of Paths of Glory. And I guess it was very moving to them. And it's funny because it's the rare emotional ending to any Kubrick movie. I find 2001 can be emotional. I remember when I saw it one time and I teared up. I was really moved by the fact. Yeah. The Star Child. Maybe we all have some kind of long-term existence. We don't even know anything about it. We're not aware of this, that we're going to be reborn over and over again, that even the ordinary person who's an astronaut, who's not that ordinary, but we all can move on. Anyway, that moved me once, at least. But most Kubrick movies are cold. And Spielberg said in that same interview on Eyes Wide Shut, I found him a very emotional director. Well, I don't think that's true. I think people said that Kubrick was cold are probably right. But the end of Paths of Glory is not cold, except I think Kubrick is fully aware of the fact that his movie is full of contradictions deliberately. And even that scene, I think, at the end is kind of mean. Not by him, but by fate, by the way these kinds of things go. These guys get a few more minutes of some fun in a bar and having a moment with this woman. The only woman in the whole movie, by the way. Movie entirely with men, except for...
But that's probably intentional, too, because and it's funny, the sight of her is shocking.
The same year, you talked about Bridge on the River Kwai, 12 Angry Men was the same year. All three of those movies have only a few women. 12 Angry Men has none. Bridge on the River Kwai has a token woman at one point, and maybe a few other ones here and there, I guess, but almost entirely
not. Not a lot of speaking parts. I don't think there's a speaking part for women in Bridge on the River.
Well, they have a little bit of dialogue, I believe, when they're all going to try to blow up the bridge, William Holden and Jack Hawkins' characters. There's some women with them. Mm-hmm. But anyway, the point is that those three major movies that same year have the same kind of theme, which is men going off to do stupid things. 12 Angry Men has not really so much that one, I guess. But anyway, there's no women in these movies. And then there's these awful endings when you look at it and say, the filmmakers get it. I'm not criticizing the filmmakers at all. I think they fully get it. But what the fuck was the point of any of that?
Well, that's his point. His point is,
no, I know. I'm
wrong. So you say he's cruel, but who's he being cruel to?
I don't think he's being cruel.
To his characters?
No, I don't think he's being cruel to his audience? The movie is, but I don't think Kubrick is. I think it's the one time where Kubrick understood how to do something that was what Spielberg would have done, I suppose, and make it more uplifting. But at the same point, pulls the rug out because they're going right back to the front in minutes. Not even tomorrow or next week.
And I say the one time he does pull his punches in this movie is that he allows Colonel Dax to continue being a hero, still sticking up for his men, so they still have him. But he sure doesn't pull his punches 7 years later when he made Dr. Strangelove.
Mm-hmm.
In that movie, there's no Colonel Dax. There's not even somebody trying to save humanity in that movie, really.
What about Mandrake? Jack, I'd love to save the world.
Yeah, but Mandrake, well, I guess Colonel Dax fails too. Okay, you got me. Yeah, you're right.
Mandrake, he's the only one in that movie.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's still a comedy, so they're
and
all
and he's the
idiots.
Only like voice of reason in mm-hmm. a world full of idiots yeah. as well. Okay, fair.
Getting back to the singing by Suzanne Christian. It reminded me of that line. Right, that's, well, she's billed that way, though. But it reminds me of that line in The Shawshank Redemption. Randy Dufresne plays that Italian song with the ladies singing mm-hmm. for everyone opera. In the prison yeah. to hear, and then he ends up getting put in the hole for 2 weeks. And Morgan Freeman's line is, I have no idea what those ladies were singing about. I don't want to know. And Suzanne Christian, same idea, where they don't know what she's even singing, and they don't really want to know.
Yeah.
So an unintentional homage, probably, for Shawshank, back to this movie. You say Dax gets off the hook. He's the one that has the line, patriotism is the last refuge of the scoundrel, quoting, I forget who it was, but anyway, he's quoting that line. I'm saying that in reality, our world now, it's the first refuge. And I think the greatest way to pinpoint that in American politics, at least, is freedom fries. Or even, hey, I saw a Western earlier today, I talked about that, John Wayne, Chisholm. I love John Wayne as an actor, but he was the ultimate chicken hawk. I'm American here, but never, ever served in the war and could have. So his patriotism is bullshit, and the modern politician's patriotism is even bigger bullshit.
It's thrown around as a total empty platitude in this movie by the officers just to justify their self-serving behavior. The foot soldiers, we never see them really be moved by patriotism. They don't seem motivated by much beyond surviving minute to minute. Even like in the note of patriotism and the war as a whole, the film doesn't bother telling us the context of the war. Why the French are even fighting? Are they fighting for their own land? Or are they fighting to take over Germany's land? Of course, anyone who's aware of history would know, although at this point in the war, I can't remember.
Well, it was only about 40 years later at that point. It wasn't that long after World War I at that point, 1957.
Yeah, but I'm saying the movie just doesn't even bother. You never see a German soldier. Yeah. You kind of
not
like
a close-up,
see,
at least.
Yeah, you see like the buildings, the structures, and you hear the shotgun blasts or whatever. But
it's like that in Platoon, you don't see the Viet Cong.
Yeah, right. There's just no point where the film steps back and gives you a notion of what these soldiers are fighting for.
Yeah.
All the patriotism is totally empty. It's just there to serve to justify the cruel behaviors of the officers.
And again, Kubrick understands that. We've seen movies in our various podcasts of the years where I'm not really sure the filmmakers understood their own movie very well, and we've criticized them for it. But he fully gets what we're talking about right now. I think that's absolutely true. He gets that this is all stupid and ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And by the way, Dax, we said he's the hero, but he does the mission rather than be relieved of his command. I guess you could say that's honorable. But he's goaded into doing it the same way that Moreau in the previous scene was goaded into doing it. So there's honor for his reasons more than Moreau's reasons. But if he really wanted to take a stand, he would say, well, I'm not going to do this because it's stupid and you're going to get all these men killed. But I suppose he wants to say, well, I'll do my best to make this work. But that's also the way soldiers are. You think of Colin Powell, who did some of the awful things he did during the Bush administration. I think he regrets that stuff, but he was trying to be a good soldier.
Mm-hmm.
The anthill, incidentally, is called the pimple in the book. I guess they thought that'd be a little bit silly for the movie. It must have been based on something real. I guess it was probably called the pimple in reality, wherever they were there. And they didn't shoot this movie on the actual locations, by the way. It was all in Germany, I guess.
Bavaria?
Okay, right. Yeah. But nothing was on the actual locations. They did a great job of restaging where they actually were. And during the attack on the anthill, for a mono movie made in 1957, it is overwhelmingly loud, including Dax's whistle.
Mm-hmm.
If this had been a modern movie, I think we would have had to cover our ears. And again, compliments for that, because that's the way it would probably be in reality. It'd be so fucking loud.
The scenes are amazing. They resemble newsreels. That may be why he chose to shoot in black and white, is because he wanted to get that real feeling. Also, it probably gave him some freedom with the cameras. He does those amazing tracking shots. I mean, a total Kubrick. All his films, he loves the tracking shots, including the battle scenes where he's going alongside the soldiers as they're going through the trenches. It's miserable. It's filthy. You feel like you're there. It's really well done. And then there's those great tracking shots through the trenches, tracking shots through the palace. Where
there are a lot of long takes in general in this movie.
Yeah, though. And the long takes are great. They force you to sit with the subject. They force you to pay more attention to the scene. So in the trenches, you're just forced to look at the faces of the men, to look at the squalor that they're living in. the one that hits me the most is at the end when, for a very long time, watching the condemned men walk towards the firing squad. And we sit with, what's his name, the weirdo?
Farrell.
The weird one, the outcast.
Timothy Carey.
And he's crying, and he's confessing.
He's blubbering.
He's blubbering. He's
begging. You don't see that in too many war movies.
No, exactly. There's this authenticity to that. That's what people would be doing if they were going to their death. You have one soldier who's taking it on the chin, another one who's unconscious. I mean, just the lack of honor in that. We are forced to stay with them for an uncomfortably long time.
Well, the Spinecast is headed up by Kirk Douglas, who we reviewed in Spartacus on the Top Nerd Project a long time ago. He's done Sony movies. He's still alive, so I can say he has done rather than he did do.
He turned 100 last year, didn't he?
I think he did. Yeah. He's still alive, despite that stroke about 20 years ago, more than 20 years ago. You could use his chin dimple for a swimming pool, and it's fascinating to look at some of the close-ups in this movie because he does get some big close-ups. Of course, he's got to be half-naked when we first see him to show how much he's been working out.
I was like, is there maybe a thematic reason why you first see him without a shirt on? No, there's not that. Don't
just
be stupid.
To show
he
off.
Just has to show everybody.
Is Dax too noble and too much of an idealist? I think Breuer is more believable, especially when he has that whole thing where, what have I done wrong?
That's the one indulgence that Kubrick made in the film, is to make Dax this perfect hero when every other character has so much more nuance and they have bravery or they have faults, but they just seem like far more real people, where Colonel Dax is just a perfect hero. He's brave, he's smart, he's noble, he's loyal. It's a little much, but at the same time, it's very Kirk Douglas-y, right? Yeah. That's really the part that he's meant to play, and I don't know if he had an influence on how the part would go down, but...
Yes, he was an executive producer on the
because right, it's his production company. So that may be part of it, too.
Bryna Productions made this movie.
Kubrick couldn't throw his weight around back then if the star and producer of your film, who is a star, is saying, I think Colonel Dax would turn down that promotion, then you got to take it.
Reminds you of the Bryan Cranston thing at the end of Breaking Bad. People
exactly,
talk about why
exactly.
Walter White gets a happy ending, and it's Bryan Cranston, who was a producer on the show at that point, too. And Vince Gilligan said, okay, fine, we'll make this work. But he knew in the end it shouldn't have quite been like that.
But this was probably the last film where... Well, actually, no, not the last film. Spartacus was the last film where Kubrick ever had to really answer to anybody. Mm. But this was the film that made him a legend. Prior to this, people were watching him. They were impressed with The Killing. The Killing was critically acclaimed, and a lot of people were very impressed. It's probably what got him Paths of Glory, but after Paths of Glory, he was a name. He could write his own ticket after that.
But both times, his boss was Kirk Douglas, who knew he'd made a classic even when it first came out. He'd been interviewed soon after, and he was saying, this is one film I know is going to hold up. It's a pretty bold statement to make. Not many actors will say that, or if they do, they're wrong.
Yeah, I mean, it's easy to give him credit for it now. For all we know, he said that about every single film he ever made.
No, he's saying that. I made a lot of movies and they weren't all great, but this one I know
is
great.
And he's right. It's still, like, absolutely, it's hard to believe it's 60 years old. It feels incredibly modern.
A third of the budget went to pay his salary. A lot of other actors were considered, which is not surprising. Charlton Heston, Gregory Peck, Richard Burton, James Mason. Mason, of course, starred in Lolita not that many years after this. All good actors. Would have been better. Maybe any of those guys. Heston would have been over the top in his own way, too. Hmm. Ralph Meeker is second billed, and he is Philippe Paris, or probably Paris in their language, but we call him Paris. He's the cool bastard in Kiss Me Deadly, which was only a few years before this. You didn't love that movie that much, but a great noir from 1955, I think it was. And then he was in The Dirty Dozen quite a few years after this. And he is pretty solid in this film as a second billed actor. Timothy Carey, we mentioned the blubbering. He's got a screw loose. Both in the movie and apparently in reality, he caused trouble on set and was fired.
Yeah.
He'd been in The Killing, and then he was in this. As you said, not a lot of actors did more than one movie with Kubrick, and he never did another movie with him because he was that much of a pain in the ass. And I guess they used somebody else in some of the shots to double for him because he'd been canned.
Yeah, but I love his performance.
Adolphe Monjou, who worked for 45 years and started in the silent era, I guess his best-known movie other than this, if you look at his IMDb credits, would be the 1937 version of A Star is Born. And I do think he's very underrated in this picture. Just like George McCready, who plays Moreau, he didn't do a lot of movies other than this in a big title kind of way. Gilda and Peyton Place on TV. I thought maybe he'd done a lot of other films. I felt like I knew that name from somewhere, that face, that voice. But I looked at his resume and didn't see a lot of other things. Monjou and McCready are very good in this movie, and I'd say they're as good as, if not better, than the star Douglas.
You know, it's funny because they're like old school Hollywood, so they have that bigger, phonier style of acting, but they're playing characters who are phony. So
yeah, it fits.
Totally works.
Joe Turkel. So here are the three movies he did with Kubrick. The Killing, The Shining, of course, as Lloyd the Bartender, and now this. And then he was also Tyrell, the guy who invents the, what are they called again, replicants in Blade Runner. So we've seen that guy's face a lot and reviewed his movies quite a few times in the last couple of years. Wayne Morris is Roger, the one who turns on Paris and sacrifices him because he got to pick somebody from his group. Emil Meyer is the priest, and he was Rufus Riker in Shane. And Richard Anderson is Moreau's lackey, and he's also the prosecutor in the Kangaroo Court. He's got a lot of screen time. I forgot how much that guy was actually on screen. He's with Moreau when he's walking through the trenches. Improving morale. No, you're intimidating, you fucking dick. I guess we talked a lot about Kubrick, but a few more things I got to say. They say online he shot 70-plus takes of that Last Supper scene when Farrell is ripping into the duck and they're all fighting and complaining about what's going to happen the next day. So they had to recook ducks because of the multiple takes and the long takes as well. And of course, we know Kubrick did a lot more takes than that in future movies, including on The Shining. They even widened the trenches what they would have been in reality because they wanted to fit the camera in there. And that is a recurring Stanley Kubrick theme. He's got a lot of recurring themes in all of his movies, but one of the main ones is parallel walls. We see it in The Shining. We see it in 2001 with The Stargate. He loved having those parallel walls and having the character trapped. In this case, it's the camera, which I guess is us. For that matter, the soldiers are trapped too. He wrote the movie along with Calder Willingham, who was the writer on The Graduate, and Jim Thompson, who was a crime novelist, so good script by them. They were nominated for the WGA, by the way, the Writers Guild Award, but didn't win. One of the few nominations this movie got in a major way. Well, it got a few big ones, I guess, but no Oscar nominations. And they based on Humphrey Cobb's 1935 novel, which went on Broadway and failed in 1935. I can see why. And I can see why this movie wasn't a huge hit in the theaters either. And the producer was James B. Harris, a Kubrick friend for quite a few years there. Kubrick uncredited was a producer, and then Douglas's company, Bryna, released it. So really, in the end, Kirk Douglas was the man in charge of all of them. The movie's 1:6:6:1 ratio, and we watched the black and white Blu-ray, which looks pretty damn good, especially in the scenes at the end when they're marching those guys in on what looks like a blue day. You can't tell because it's black and white. It looks like a nice, sunny blue day. And they show a lot of close-ups, a lot of shots of the sky with the camera pointing up, and it is pretty flawless. I'm not sure the whole movie was flawless, but I really noticed that towards the end. You could just take a screenshot and it would be perfect.
It was a great print. Really excellent.
Cinematographer was George, although I think it's Georg Kraus. He's a German who shot a lot of B films. A lot of Germans, actually, as was Eva Kroll. She did a lot of foreign films as the editor, if I didn't say that, yeah. And a lot of titles in her resume sound like German flicks. I didn't look, but I'm sure they're German movies. The musician was Gerald Fried, who did Killer's Kiss and The Killing before this. He's nearly 90 and still working now.
What music was there in the movie? There's like snare drum. There's not very much score at all.
Well, smartly, I guess.
Yeah.
But if you're involved in the composing at all, then you're going to get credit for that. Easy
gig. Drum roll, please. Oh, that's it. We're done. Go home.
Okay, the influence. I mentioned the David Simon thing with The Wire and that war is the only genre Kubrick came back to more than once. Spielberg's D-Day attack in Saving Private Ryan had to be influenced by the attack on the anthill. Mm-hmm. And right down to the sound design in a 5.1 modern audio setting, overwhelming. One of the great sound designs in any movie would be that 10 or 15 minute sequence when they attack on D-Day. And then also, this happened in reality, but in the movie Patton, he loses his career for slapping a soldier he accused of cowardice. And Moreau is going to lose his career for killing people because they are supposedly showing cowardice.
Attempting to kill people. They didn't get the written order, so they didn't actually...
But I'm saying that Patton lost his career for something kind of stupid that he did in the spur of the moment, and Moreau was the same.
Oh, sure. Okay.
All right, the awards and list section is not very long. No Oscar nominations. It was nominated for the Writers Guild Award, like I said, and the BAFTA for Best Picture, but didn't win that. It went into the National Film Registry in 2002, and that was a great year for movies. We've covered all of these titles. Birth of a Nation, The Gold Rush, Double Indemnity, Psycho, Bonnie and Clyde, Nashville, and Annie Hall.
Oh, you're not kidding.
That's all right. AFI movies, and we covered them so long ago. Birth of a Nation was our very first one ever. And the movie's only other AFI nomination, besides the main list it didn't make, was the top 100 genres in the courtroom category. And maybe should have made that too, but it did not. All right, last thoughts on Paths of Glory. A great movie, glad we saw it, and a very emotionally affecting movie, which is unusual for Stanley Kubrick.
As the years go on, and as a big Kubrick fan, and as we've been rewatching all of his films for the project, I think the more I watch his films, the higher Paths of Glory creeps up the list of my favorites. It keeps getting better and better. It's such an excellent film, and it's so gutsy. You know, there are very few directors that wouldn't pull their punches, but he puts you there and he forces you to look right at it and still makes an excellent movie.
And so early in his career to be doing that too. It's a pretty gutsy thing to do when you're still trying to get yourself established.
Yeah, it was not his fourth film though. So he's had some practice.
But he wasn't a headline director. He wasn't a huge
name. And you're right. It's a very risky film to make when you're still trying to make a career.
But in the case of this and Bridge on the River Kwai that same year, which have similar storylines, and that was the Best Picture winner, and it was a huge hit, they both have the downer ending where so many people we care about are dead or disgraced, in the case of Paths of Glory. But they're both based on actual books and incidents. So maybe that's one reason why they work as well, that people may have heard at some point, maybe even read those books and said, this isn't some made-up thing.
It's funny that they both came out in the same year because they have such similar themes. And I wonder if there's something about being just over a decade removed from a terrible war like World War II that gives people the distance to be introspective.
Not that many years after Korea as well.
Yeah, so maybe the public was in a mood to look back and maybe stop looking through the lens of patriotism and start paying attention to what caused all that chaos in the first place.
The difference is in Paths of Glory, it's World War I, and it's not even Americans, it's French and German. Well, we don't see the Germans.
But I bet that that's why the film could get... If the movie was about Americans, the film never would have been seen in America. It wasn't seen in France until the 70s. They banned it. I think they had to make it about France, because nobody in America would stand for it if they believed that American military
Well, luckily
did
the
that.
Book was about French soldiers.
Of course, but it never would have gotten greenlit, is my point, if it was about American soldiers.
All right, the next time you hear us, it will be June 5th. Our podcast that day is a rather well-liked entry in the sci-fi genre. Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan! Khan! The coming attraction trivia for Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. Of the six movies starring the original series cast, how many of them earned more than $100 million when adjusted for inflation? Did they all get that much? Did none of them get that much? How many got $100 million adjusted?
So, for the answer to that question, please check out our next podcast. And in the meantime, if you'd like more from Ryan and me, please check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. While you're there, check out our entire roster of podcasts. We've covered over 200 movies now, including all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and 2007 lists of the best American movies ever made. Every episode is available for free. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I'm at BevEllisEllis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once more, we would like to warmly thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee.
The paths of glory lead us to the cut.
And cut.
Told you.